Good afternoon. I'll call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order and note we do have a quorum present. Representative Johnson, have you had a chance to review the minutes for March 5th?
Chair Howard, I have, and I move to approve the minutes.
All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. We have three bills up today. The first bill is House File 685, Representative Igbaje. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Igbaje?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill as well as the DE3 amendment.
Representative Igbaje moves the House File 685 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee, and she moves the DE3 amendment. We'll just adopt the DE and have you present the bill. All those in favor of the DE3 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The DE3 is adopted. Representative Igbaje, to your bill.
Thank you. Glad to be back again to discuss House File 685 with the updated changes now in the DE3 amendment that is now adopted. So last year we heard how the bill is a start at addressing the trend of corporate and investor-owned housing in our housing market. The bill, as amended through the DE3, would limit corporate entities from buying single-family homes for the sole purpose of turning them into rental properties. There are some exceptions to the limitations. Corporations that own less than 10 properties would be exempt from the provisions in this bill. Additional entities like nonprofits, trusts, and builders are exempt from the provisions in this bill. And the remedy at this time that we're looking at is that a corporation would need to divest from its excess holdings, and for properties that have tenants, those tenants would have the right, first right to purchase the property. Other corporations not listed in our list of exemptions can apply for an exemption from this prohibition if the exemption would not preclude the goal of owner-occupied home ownership. Currently, we're looking at enforcement through the Attorney General's office, and the Minnesota Housing would manage the exemption list. But we continue with discussions with various entities on the best paths for those goals. As we have discussed multiple times in this committee, home ownership in Minnesota is something that continues to be out of reach, particularly for Minnesotans of color and working class Minnesotans. The reasons are varied, but corporate home ownership of single family homes is definitely a factor. According to reports from the Federal Reserve, Pew Charitable Trusts, and reporting done by the Star Tribune and others, corporate entities are purchasing more homes in the marketplace to the detriment of many first time home buyers. Corporate ownership has doubled their share of the market in Minnesota from 2006 until now, and the trends show that these purchases are concentrated in black and brown or low-income neighborhoods. Recent studies in the metro area show that there are higher concentrations of corporate-owned housing in communities like Northeast Minneapolis, suburbs of Fridley and Hopkins, and in those areas, corporate home ownership of single-family homes is 30%, 24%, and 27%, respectively. In many of these areas, the share of large corporate owners is growing, and we also see it in communities in greater Minnesota, too. This means that in those communities, families and working people are continually shut out of the marketplace from corporate owners who can offer cash and forego inspection fees and other costs that regular Minnesotans can't. This leaves them with the only option to rent from these corporate landlords if they want to stay in their neighborhoods. So part of the reason why we continue with a proposal like this is to find a way to also address the issue of corporate owners who can sometimes be absentee landlords. They have limited property management oversight, and they don't address repairs in a timely fashion. So we've heard stories from folks that show that the only time you hear from certain corporate landlords is when the rent is due, but never anytime else. And some of the most egregious issues were out, as we all know, from last year and the year before, Havenbrook Homes in Minneapolis. But by limiting the amount of single-family homes that corporate entities can own, hopefully we can have more homeowners and more people that are present in their communities. That is the general purpose of this bill. The measure is meant to ensure that Minnesotans, wherever they are, know that they will compete in a more even playing field to get an opportunity at home ownership. Home ownership, as we all say, builds wealth and opportunity for people and for their future generations. So let's work to that opportunity by removing this a barrier to the American dream. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it to testifiers and then answer questions.
The first testifier we have is Beth Gendler.
Not the only one who's done that now.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard, members of the committee. My name is Beth Gendler.
I'm the Executive Director of Jewish Community Action. We organize the Minnesota Jewish community as part of state and local coalitions addressing racial and economic justice in Minnesota. And I'm here today as a member of the Equity in Place Coalition speaking in support of this bill. In 2008, JCA's work in North Minneapolis with people at risk of foreclosure during the financial crisis gave us a firsthand look at the drastic transformation that was beginning in the single-family home market. Corporate speculation on and purchase of these properties has priced Minnesota families out of these homes, worsening the racial home ownership gap and leading to increased housing insecurity and displacement. Lower-income communities have not recovered from the 2008 foreclosure crisis. In fact, home ownership by Black Minnesotans has continued to decline every year since 2000, giving Minnesota the unfortunate distinction of being one of the worst states in the country for Black home ownership. Outside corporate ownership is a contributing factor, and we have the power to mitigate it in Minnesota. Barriers to home ownership are not the only reason to limit corporate ownership. A recent study of single-family rentals in North Minneapolis found that people living in homes owned by large investor operators, reported worse conditions, higher fees, and greater discrimination than those living in homes owned by smaller property owners. Institutional investors often sit on properties in anticipation of appreciation, and the neighborhood and tenants suffer from lack of basic upkeep. JCA supports housing in community hands. In our work, we're seeing increasing numbers of Minnesotans priced out of the market, unable to compete with well-funded corporations who can offer full cash payment up front. And this isn't just a City of Minneapolis problem. It's felt acutely in our work across suburban Hennepin County as the stock for single-family homes becomes further out of reach for residents of moderate income as well. Representative Bajje, thank you for authoring this important legislation, and thank you to the committee members for your support.
Thank you. Next, we have Pat Paulson. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Howard, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak on HF 685. I'm Pat Paulson, a realtor in the metro area for 38 years. I'm also the 2024 treasurer of the Minnesota Realtors, which has a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals statewide, active in all aspects of the real estate transaction. While we appreciate efforts that attempt to support home ownership, we have significant concerns with HF 685 and its use of market restrictions. A well-functioning market provides consumers with choices. Many tenant households seek single-family homes for rent. Restricting investor ownership of single-family homes will result in less options for tenants, confining many to large apartment buildings. Also, please keep in mind that even in the most extreme seller's markets, some homes don't sell, and an investor may be the only interested buyer. Sales have dropped by a third in the last 2 years. If this bill passes, and then the market shifts completely, we may experience some of the same issues as we did in the aftermath of the 2008 housing crash. Not enough buyers, resulting in many single-family homes going through foreclosure, sitting vacant, and falling into disrepair. We've heard concerns raised about large institutional investors. However, the threshold, ownership threshold in this bill is 10 or more. That impacts small local investors. This bill also has a provision requiring corporate owners who own more than 10 rental properties to divest of the properties within 2 years. This is a clear violation of private property rights and would also displace existing tenants. Minnesota has the third highest home ownership rate in the nation. We think building on that strong base by focusing on strategies that will create more housing generally and more types of housing through legislation like the Missing Middle Housing Bill, or perhaps creating a reduced tax rate on capital gains for investor owners who sell to a first-time home buyer, are better options than creating market restrictions. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 685. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Abaje regarding our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Tammy Ogunrinde. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Tami Ogunwunde, and I'm the Equity and Engagement Director at Urban Homeworks. Chair Howard, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding House File 685. Thank you, Representative Agbaje, for moving this bill forward and allowing me to testify on behalf of Urban Homeworks, our residents, and larger community. Urban Homeworks provides affordable housing and homeownership opportunities in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Because of the work we do, we know the importance of this bill passing. We supported it last year and still support the passing of House File 685. I want to highlight a 2023 Federal Reserve report that showed just four entities own over 100 single-family homes in Minnesota. Bridgman Investment Group owns 214 and is based in Salt Lake City. Progress Residential owns 602 and is based in Scottsdale. Invitation Homes owns 1,040 and is based in Dallas. Home Partners of America owns 1,152 and is based in Chicago. We've allowed out-of-state entities to extract wealth from hardworking Minnesotans. We have allowed four corporations to price out over 3,000 homes from Minnesotans looking to achieve their dream of home ownership. I only named four entities. We know that there are hundreds of other investors who own many homes throughout the state, pricing out potential homeowners. If we are to be a state that truly puts Minnesota first, then we should support a bill that prevents out-of-state entities and corporations from buying our homes at the expense of our neighbors, families, friends, and all who call Minnesota home. These practices are deeply inequitable. There's a negative disparate impact that investor ownership is having on communities such as North Minneapolis, where investor ownership is occurring at over 20%. Not only does this prevent many BIPOC families from building wealth through home ownership, but this extracts income from hardworking Minnesota families and puts it into the pockets of corporations who don't reside in these communities or even the state. These entities aren't looking to better community or impact neighbors for good. They are simply seeking to grow profits and expand their portfolios. House File 685 would give Minnesotans the fighting chance they deserve to purchase a home. This bill doesn't outright eliminate the ability to purchase single-family homes. It just limits the amount they could own. Investors are still able to have 10 single-family homes in their portfolio while also adding triplexes, duplexes, and other forms of real estate into their portfolio. This bill doesn't prevent them from building their wealth, but it does create barriers for that wealth to be attained through single-family homes, widening the path for Minnesotans to achieve their dream of home ownership. Lastly, House File 685 is part of a holistic plan to dismantle the systems of old that have for so long kept Minnesota families, specifically BIPOC families, on the sidelines of home ownership. This bill, in partnership with Agbaje's down payment assistance, Urban Homeworks direct appropriation, and other bills working to increase supply, this gives us a true fighting chance to bring housing justice and equitable access to communities throughout Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? If not, we can go to member discussion. Member discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, let me say to the author, thanks for some of the changes you've made. We have talked about it, and you know that I'm still opposed to this. And there's a number of questions that I have. I did watch your press conference over lunch, and was I heard you quote a study by the Fed, and the Fed has an online tool that they showed us detailing some of the numbers. And I've got numbers for a lot of the folks here in committee, but I looked at your district and the number of people that a number of instances above 20 houses in the 20 bucket is 268, which is 7%. 50 is 6%. 100 is 6.9%. I think I heard a much different number from the press conference, that it was upwards of 50%. And maybe I didn't hear you properly in the press conference, but the numbers based on the Fed that would have fueled the report are different. And I'm wondering if you could maybe help me understand that.
Representative McBajie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. I think a lot of the numbers that were talked about in the press conference today were also different metrics of the areas. So if you're looking at just my district, that is just one portion of Minneapolis. We talked about both Twin Cities, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. We also talked about the metro area. So I think depending on which area you're looking at, which geographic area you're looking at, the numbers might change.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also looked at Minneapolis in aggregate, and we stopped at those that were in the 50-home range. Minneapolis has the number of homes owned by one investor that is at 50 or above is still only 3.13%. St. Paul, 3.72. Woodbury, 2%. Blaine, 1.57. Richfield, 2.42. And maybe you and I could sit in my office and run through the numbers, because I love data, and I think you do too. I'm still not seeing the numbers borne out, but I will move on to my next question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm all about process, Mr. Chair, always through the chair. I guess one of the sticking points, and I mentioned this last time when we did this last year, was the constitutionality of depriving somebody their Fifth Amendment rights relative to the right of property. And this seems to be directly in contravention to the Fifth Amendment. And I know nothing is unconstitutional until a court finds it, so I'm with you on that one. But it seems to me, even in a plain text reading of the Fifth Amendment, that I do have the right to property. And I don't know that anybody wants to say that, but I was particularly struck by the comment that one of your testifiers made, that we will be dismantling systems of old. And I really hope that the Constitution is not one of the systems of old that we're trying to get rid of. But you and I have spoken, and I understand that there is a desire to preclude. I think that at one time Russian oligarchs were mentioned by somebody in a press conference or an article somewhere, not you, but and I certainly understand the sentiment there. But going back to my reference of last year, you put together a group of investors, of which I might be one, and I now have to stop at 10, even though I might choose to make investments in different parts of the state, which in aggregate would push me over that number. And my argument is still that, short of having, for lack of a better word, let's just call it an LLC or a corporation or whatever, a group of people who get together, some of those houses may never actually be buyable by anybody else, because that group of investors may be the only one that has sufficient capital to play it out over the long run. So a single family dwelling. And we've all seen, right, the Instagram where we bought a dump and we've spent the next 9 years fixing it up. That's not the frequent refrain that I've been hearing. So I am concerned about that. I am also troubled by the due process aspect of how you intend to dispose of those over the number, because I do not believe that a letter from the attorneys general to require somebody to divest themselves is due process. So, and that is in your lines 3.21 through 3.33. And I'm wondering, as one of the lawyers on this, if you could talk about how that constitutes due process, because that not any definition that I know of it. But I'm not a lawyer.
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot to unpack there, Representative Nash.
I do that a couple times.
I don't really know where to start. Maybe we'll just start at kind of the philosophical disagreement I think that we have. You talk about the property rights of a corporation. I'm still on the property rights of an individual, of a family, that wants to own property in this country. Where do they come in? If they're being shut out of the market with corporations who have thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, can buy up whole neighborhoods at one time, where are their property rights? I think that's just a question that I think we have to come up with to figure out how do we allow a more level playing field in this space. You know, we did open space up for the mom and pop shop landlords. We don't want to preclude that from folks. And as one of the testifiers said, you know, they can buy up to 10 single family homes, but they're also capable of buying multifamily homes too, diversifying their portfolios, providing spaces for rent for multiple people who maybe aren't ready for home ownership. But for those who are, I've had multiple people come up to me or be in my email saying this bill, the concept in this bill would help me so much to be able to buy a home because I was prevented from buying a home from a corporation. So that's, I think that's just our philosophical disagreement about this bill, and what we're trying to do is to do right by Minnesotans who also want to activate their own property rights. So I guess under our Constitution, who weighs more? In terms of the due process aspect for divestment, I mean, this is an area that's still undergoing conversation and negotiation, so I take your comments about due process in good faith, and I think we'll go back and look to make sure that the structure there makes sense for when someone is found in violation.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify or crystallize the conversation, property rights are imbued only to those who own property. So the property rights of somebody who has yet to acquire property, I think that's, we're going to have another semantical disagreement there, I would imagine. But I would also imagine that that would be upheld by a court, that you don't have property rights until you acquire it. So those who are aspiring to acquire property don't yet have property rights. Would you agree with that?
Representative Bajay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, again, I think we're going to have a philosophical disagreement here. I mean, most likely, legally, I mean, you probably don't have property rights to protect if you haven't owned property yet, but we're getting at the question of folks who want to own property. I mean, I would say you and I agree on home ownership, mm-hmm. and that home ownership is something that people in America should want to strive for. Yeah. But if they're not even being able to enter the market in some of these states, some of these cities, and in some of our own communities. So I guess if you're talking about property rights, if people are being prevented from even accessing that in the first place, I think that's a problem that we have.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to be brief. I'm not always successful at that. But, and I'm not trying to make this a debate round or a courtroom battle, although I love debate. Once again, a person doesn't have imbued to them property rights until they are actually the owner of said property. And I think I just want to make sure that we're not sort of confusing the notion of property rights, because I think any court would agree that you don't have property rights until you own property. Now, the aspirational qualities of owning property I fully support. I think it's great that somebody wants to be able to do that. But once again, I have great problems, and I forgot to put into the record the article by Jerusalem Demsis that I shared last year. Talking about that this is not really as pernicious a problem as has been alleged. And the numbers we've shared have borne that out. And that's from the same data source that you and I were both speaking about today from the Fed. I just don't see it. And as a result, I have a groaning list of reasons that I can't vote for the bill. And you're not surprised. But I think that it's not as big of a problem as is being shared, that often those, we'll call them institutional buyers. So those institutional housing providers or owners or whatever descriptor we'd like to use, that it's not that, not really that pernicious. I have a problem with the way that effectively that these owners would be forced into divestment. And I do hope that you're negotiating with somebody to work on the process, because I do think that that is a deprivation of due process. If I just simply come up to you and say, Esther, I don't like your car, I'm going to force you to sell it, or you have 10 cars or 11 cars, I'm going to make you sell that 11th car, that's a little impractical and kind of an affront to just common sense. So I would say that that's a problem. But there's just a lot of problems. Once again, you're not surprised by that, but I can't vote for this bill, and without stepping on Lee Johnson's, I'm going to ask for a roll call on this, Mr. Chair.
There will be a roll call, and we'll go on to other folks. I just want to mention I've got that same Minneapolis Fed data up, and when you break it out by neighborhoods, you'll find that there's many neighborhoods in Minneapolis, St. Paul, that have 20, 20, 25% investor-owned properties. And those are the in Minneapolis, we're talking about the Hawthorne neighborhood. We're talking about North Minneapolis. In St. Paul, we're talking about Frogtown and North End and some of our, you know, more areas where we have more pronounced racial gaps. So I just wanted to mention that. Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Obadje. One thing we do have a real strong agreement on is home ownership. I think you know that I see the value in ownership of homes, and the value of that building generational wealth is extremely important. Question I have is do you assume that what investors, every single family rental should be owner-occupied with this, or where's the end game with this?
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dossett. No, we do have that carve-out that corporations can still own up to 10 single-family homes, so not everywhere in the market would just be owner-occupied. But ideally, I do think owner-occupation is what we should be striving for, since that's what people want.
Representative Dossett.
What I have experienced, at least I've witnessed, is consumers like choices, and not every consumer may necessarily want to rent an apartment. There are some consumers that would prefer to rent a home. Would you not agree with that?
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Representative Dotseth, that we are still allowing a lower threshold where corporations can still own up to 10 single-family homes for rental, and there are a number of corporations and businesses and individual landlords who can afford to buy up to 10 properties, and they can rent those out.
Representative Dotseth.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bajay, Chair Howard. You bring up a good point. The 10 homes, how do we come up with the magical number of 10? Because I find that, my experience is I've witnessed a lot of families that try to, especially after the crash in, 2008, 2012, a lot of families diverted their investments into investing into housing. And with that, they've been building generational wealth for their family and for their kids and their grandkids. It really appears that this may still be an attack on maybe I should rephrase it, not attack, but the effect on a lot of the smaller mom-and-pop type of operations. Is there a reason you came up with the magic number 10? Can you explain a little bit more to me, please?
Representative Bajay.
Chair Howard, Representative Dotseth. Again, 10 is the number where we're starting at. If there's a better number, we are in negotiations with folks who are working with us, also in negotiations with the Senate. But we realize that for a lot of smaller mom-and-pop shops, 10 properties is a pretty big portfolio to handle. We are leaving space for those smaller landlords in this bill.
Representative Dotseth?
I do recall, thank you, Representative Bajay. I'm just concerned about the displacement that this may potentially cause as some of these investors are diverted to actually being forced to sell some of their properties. And there may be a void, basically that missing middle that may actually affect a lot of these potential renters. And it may create a bigger challenge than we may create a problem rather than solve a problem as we move forward here. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Representative Bajay.
Chair Howard, Representative Dotseth. The missing middle bill is definitely about advancing home ownership, I believe, and advancing choice in housing. Again, here, I think going back to your statements, we are still leaving a marketplace for smaller landlords. If that number needs to be increased, we can do that. If there are other, in terms of displacement, that is a conversation that we are having with folks. We want to make sure that whatever process we use to enact the remedy does not lead to further displacement. So that's still a conversation that we're having. If you have ideas, I welcome them. We want to make sure that we are building that in so that way we're not creating another problem. But we are quite aware of that, and we are working on language and ways to kind of make sure that we are preventing that from happening.
Thank you, Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Representative Bajay. Can you just give me more clarity of the number 10? How did we come up with that number 10?
Representative Bajay.
Chair Howard, Representative Dotseth, the number 10 is just a starting point.
Representative Dotseth.
You know, I can appreciate a starting point, but I think we're moving a little fast with this bill at this point. I think there should be more discussion and actually get some of the players involved in regards to this. I think it's just really, it really is a breach on property rights. And I really wonder, is this really a legal process that we can proceed with?
Representative Bajay.
Chair Howard, Representative Dasseth. So 10, if you want to get more technical, most reports and researchers will use the number 50 for larger investors, and 10 is usually around small investors. So because we want to be able to leave space in the market for small investors, that's why we started there. We may move up, we may move down, depending on additional data and research that we have. To your second question, I've forgotten it now, I'm sorry.
Is this legal?
Yes.
Have you gotten a written statement from the Attorney General in regards to this?
Representative Bajay.
You know, we can go to the Attorney General, but, I mean, these are the types of proposals that we're seeing in different states and different cities and also at the federal government. So, yes.
Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I think I'll move on so other people can have their comments. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I want to get back to just kind of more of an overall view here. So this committee is responsible for housing and trying to improve the housing market and the available housing for people out there. And whether we pass this bill or not, we also have to agree that it doesn't change the number of housing units available, because it just switches it from ownership to rental property. So that's part of that. And whereas it's very laudable for us to start to think about how can we make housing more affordable for individuals' personal needs, that's also very good. But this, I want to take us back to, this is actually more than just when it's owned by a corporation. It also goes back to the previous owner. Because when you make decisions like this, you're also limiting the previous seller, the person that's owned it. It's a single person, I'm assuming, or an individual family. What you're doing is you're telling them that they can't sell it to whoever they wish. If it's a corporation that offers more money, you can't sell it to them because they can't have ownership of it. And I think that's something that we need to be very careful about because of that. And I've heard a couple of statements, well, people are kept out of the market. Well, that increased cost for that house that you say is being kept off market, that is true with everything that we have when it's competitive sales. And so now, are we trying to limit it for this particular purpose? What are the far-extending circumstances that may be ongoing or something that we don't really know is going to happen in the future? We don't know. But this impacts more than just whether or not corporations own this. If you're saying, well, larger corporations tend to abuse rent or whatever, unfortunately, bad actors can handle that and can do that at 10 units or less, and so can nonprofits. So we have to be careful that we focus in on what is the need and what are we trying to accomplish with that. I would like us to see how we can get more housing units out there, that we can get more availability for people to work from rental properties into their own, et cetera, and work at that piece. This is one of those areas that I have a hard time believing that restrictive selling policies for somebody who wants to sell their house is going to be beneficial in the long run, especially since it won't change a single one of the housing units available for people to be housed in. So that's just a challenge as I see, and one that I'm sure that you'll continue to work on as well. Thank you.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Apache, I understand what you're looking at doing here. But first of all, I do have a quick question. I'm getting conflicting information. We're not just talking about single-family homes here. We're also talking about duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes. Can you give me the definition of a single-family home?
Representative Igbaje.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. So we're using, and House Research can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we're using the definition of homestead for single-family homes. And so that has a definition in law in Chapter 273. And then also, I think, you know, most of the single-family homes in Minnesota are, I think there's a number of descriptions wherever they are. But, I mean, the idea is that these are under the tax code that there's one family living there or one person who's the homesteader living there. But House Research can correct me if I'm wrong in my details.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badge. Actually, under Minnesota statute 46C.02, it's one of the four units on the property is considered a single-family home. So some of the numbers that you've been giving might probably include rental properties with a fourplex or a threeplex or a duplex. We're talking about individual family homes with one unit is what we're talking about. That's what most people want to buy. They want to have their own place where their kids can go in the backyard and play, where they can park their car if they have one, where the neighborhood kids can come over and play softball or whatever in the backyard, play football. So I think we got to deal with that because most duplexes, threeplex, and triplex and quadplexes are actually rental units. They're not single-family homes. The owner might live in one of them. Well, like my cousin did, he built a duplex to help build equity and pay for the home he built, but didn't take long for him to get rid of it because he didn't like all the headaches. Now, there's some other issues I have with this bill. And I agree with you on that home ownership is the best outcome for every individual. Because that not only brings equity into there, it brings generational wealth. This bill is actually, I have a feeling it's going to do the opposite. You might have a problem with it in your district. But I was looking at your district map, and you have a lot of apartment buildings. So it's an issue that is impacting your district. It's impacting some other areas of Minneapolis, some in St. Paul. But by the numbers we're actually seeing, those that own more than one isn't that great by the percentages. But what was really interesting, I was reading about from the Bipartisan Policy Center, one of their studies. And the opening paragraph, over the last few decades, Minneapolis failed to build enough housing to support population growth, resulting in unaffordable housing prices. From 2010 to 2016, the city added more than 37,000 residents and only 12,000 housing units. Minneapolis also saw a decline of 15,000 affordable units since 2010 as prices increased for many previously affordable units. When you have inflation like we had the last couple of years, we already know rent goes up the highest, and that pushes people out of the area. And then another problem that we have Minneapolis created this is their 2020 comprehensive plan. It's under appeal right now, but it's still going on. Because in 2019, Minneapolis City Council approved their 2040 plan, which effectively started in 2020, took and banned the building of single-family homes in the city of Minneapolis. So what did that do? If you have a home, it drove up the price. And we know that for every $1,000 of increase in price, it drives 4,000 people out of the market. Now, you're talking about a problem that Minneapolis created for themselves. And it's an issue, and Minneapolis has the other issue of their landlocked. There's nowhere for them to grow anymore for land. But the policies you're pushing for Minneapolis to solve the problem in your district affects every square inch of of land in the state of Minnesota, affecting every property owner, affecting those who want to build wealth and generational wealth for their families. And some of them are struggling right now just to get by, but they're doing the work, buying the rundown houses, fixing them up, renting them out if they can't find somebody to buy them for a while, but they will go on the market. Free market works the best, and restrictions make things worse. In fact, another study by them, that same group, the Bipartisan Policy Center, in expanding affordable housing opportunities, zoning and land use studies, the last line of it, of this study, the same study found that policies to increase land use restrictions resulted in an increase of medium rent of $50. So the policies being put forth by the city of Minneapolis and restrictions on what the land can be used for, such in their 2040 plan, is creating the problem. Now, you talked about corporations not being able to have more than 10. Minnesota has a possibility of having a boom town. We found hydrogen here. Or helium? Sorry about helium. But with that, we have a possibility, if they can ever get through the permitting process, of bringing a lot of wealth to Minnesota again. But when that starts, they're going to have to get housing quickly for those employees. So this actually bans a corporation from building housing for the employees that they could use until they can find their own home. But that's a whole other issue. Right now, I also did some checking for affordable houses in Minneapolis. Right now, for sale, there's 43 houses under $150,000 in the entire city of Minneapolis. A bill like this is going to make the value of those homes go up dramatically, because it can be less people that can afford them, and they're either going to sit there and not be sold, go into foreclosure. Yeah, the prices will come down, but by the time they're sold, there's going to be so much work, they're probably not usable. So I guess I would be careful how you do this. And I have a lot of trouble with these bills that affect a small portion of the state, that affect every square inch of it. So with that, I cannot support this bill, and I'm glad Representative Nash actually requested the roll call, because there's a lot of problems with this bill that need to be looked at. And because, like I say, it affects the entire state, where a lot of the state doesn't have this issue, and a lot of the state where we need more rental units available, because we have workforce housing issues in a lot of areas of the state outside of the metro area.
A couple other members did jump on the list, so I'll go to Representative Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I can be fairly quick. Thank you, Representative Abaje. To quote a fellow legislator, I think this bill is probably going to take a tool out of our toolbox, especially when we need that investment in the suburbs. I think everybody knows that, you know, we have some housing challenges, and I do have a level of frustration. I just seem to hear bill over bill with a kind of top-down approach that's led to a lot of deficiencies. And, you know, where I live, we need that financial investment. We need that so that they can rehab these homes. We need to see growth in our suburbs, and I'm afraid that this bill is going to lead to lack of investment and lack of housing there.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, to our wonderful vice chair of this committee for bringing this up. You know, I play Monopoly with my soon-to-be five-year-old daughter, believe it or not, because we don't come from a generational wealth standpoint where houses are passed down and passed down. I come from a family that was the first time of home buying, and I'm a renter in a community where we're affected, whether it is Minneapolis or St. Paul or even going to our northern great city of Duluth. And I'm hearing from constituents in my district and outside that we need 685 to have an agenda of what home ownership looks like. I'm tired of having to play the reality of real-life Monopoly when it comes to our communities being displaced and the homelessness crisis when folks, the reality is that 44% of our renters are paying more than 30% of what they receive in a salary base, who want to become home buyers, who want to be able to afford to live in a place that if they want to become renters, they want to afford to rent there. Whoever's owning it, but the reality is, and that's what this place is, that those homeowners don't even live in our district, have never even came to the district of where they're buying these cash-out homes and residential properties, can't even get on a phone call to fix a light bulb, let alone a pipage in the sewage. This is way more than what is being expressed and what I'm hearing from the other side. It's about decency and a human right of what housing means for our future. Whether you're living in the metropolitan area, whether you're living in the communities that have had to face the displacement, that have been there for generations to say, we want to own, but unfortunately we're playing the Zillow lottery game here. And that's the accessibility of what we're fighting for right here with this bill of 685. So thank you. It must be harsh to try to continue because I don't like to debate, but I'm really good at it in different forms and ways. I'd like to find a conclusion of where we're going to go to see that there's justice for every Minnesotan to have a roof over their head. So thank you. Appreciate you.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And thank you, Vice Chair Egbaje, for bringing this bill forward. This is one that, you know, when it came forward before and we were having conversations about what might this look like, reaching out to community in greater Minnesota and hearing that, you know, is this more of a problem in the metro, though it is continuing to grow. I think a very clear-cut example of that in my own community is billionaire Kathy Cargill. You may have seen in the paper recently purchased up over 7 homes in a neighborhood that has continued to be hit with homes being converted into short-term rentals and luxury housing for the wealthy. And these 7 homes took off, not just bought, but demolished them for the price tag of $4.6 million on 14 parcels. And so when we talk about property rights and the rights of our public interest, what I'm hearing from our community, from young families who are concerned about how are we going to keep our kids in the school district, from workers and employers who are trying to make sure that we have good paying jobs and that people can live in their communities, and from seniors on fixed income who are saying, is this premium price raising the bar and the benchmark on what that's going to do to our property taxes? And we've worked so hard in this committee and others to make sure that we're getting that relief so that people can stay in their homes. And so this is something that is on the horizon, and I think right now what we've seen in the data that, you know, more needs to be done to really analyze and look at beyond the metro. But I can tell you that from our community up north, this is real and it is setting up, and we have a moment right now before it continues to expand to make sure that we do this in a way that allows folks to be able to continue to provide that housing, you know, for some folks in our community who are going to be really awesome landlords and rent those out and help people to be able to get steady and to purchase a home. But I think this is really about those material differences and making sure that we're balancing that scale so that it's not tilted away from everyday Minnesotans in favor of corporations who are coming up and not just converting these into rental units, but I want to caution that homes are being demolished and taken offline, and it's just an unknown that we have the opportunity to account for and prevent now. So thank you.
I'm going to go to Representative Baje for the final words, but just want to make a brief comment. One, just I thank the committee for the dialogue today and acknowledge that there's some issues raised that I think will be part of the ongoing discussion about the bill. What I'm struck by is I hear a lot of us saying, in a sense, we need to build more homes. We need to create more choices, more opportunities for home ownership. I believe this bill is part of that direction. There's other bills like the missing middle bill that we heard and had bipartisan support that helps do that. But for Minnesota families that find themselves in a bidding war with a faceless corporation and are unable to secure that dream of home ownership when you have some hedge fund out east competing with, you know, that's a real thing. I think all of us hear about those stories. And so I just believe that this bill can be part of an agenda where we have shared values. And so I'm going to, if it's right, go to Representative Cha.
Just like to make a brief comment. Thanks, Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill forward. I just want to add to this conversation in the future that we need to have a conversation around purchasing contracts and brokers and how real estate is really done, okay? I won't get into the details, but I was an underwriter. I was a mortgage broker for many years, you know. My friend sold 190 million homes. I've seen these contracts. And so one of the conversations that I want us to have in the future is one about how contracts are being accepted and written. And that's all. Thanks.
Representative Baje, you get the final word.
Thank you. Thank you again for the lively debate. I agree, and I thank my colleagues on the other side for bringing up some of the points that we're already grappling with. And I really do encourage you, please, you know, and I shared this with Representative Nash multiple times, please send me your ideas. I want to incorporate as many of them as I can. For the rest of it, I mean, this is really an opportunity for us as, you know, Minnesotans to be able to help other Minnesotans be able to purchase a home if that's what they desire. Right now we are seeing a market that is completely or that is predominantly skewed towards corporate interests. And we have given space for corporations in this bill. So we know that that's always going to be a part of our market. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're not shutting out regular people from this dream of home ownership, from this ability to become a property owner, from this ability to live out what's in our Constitution. So I appreciate the conversation. I look forward to more discussions with a variety of stakeholders as we continue to refine this bill. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Baje, I'll renew Representative Baje's motion that House File 685, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And there has been a roll call requested, and so Ms. Erdahl will take the roll.
Chair Howard.
Aye.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Aye.
Lee Johnson.
No.
Representative Cha.
Aye.
Representative Dotsas.
Not yet, no.
Representative Hassan.
Hassan votes aye.
Representative Hussein.
Hussein is aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative Myers.
Nay.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Norris.
Aye.
Representative Perez Vega.
Perez Vega. Aye, aye, aye.
Representative Petersburg.
No.
Eight. Vote of 8-5, the motion passes and the bill is re-referred. Representative Baje, you get to stay up there. I would note for members, we are approved to go long today, so we are going to take up our two bills that we have left. We have 1094 and then a bill after this, but just wanted to let members know that. So next up is 1094, Representative Baje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill also has an A2 amendment to put it in the shape that needs to be, so if I can move the A2 amendment.
I'll move it for you, but I'll move that 1094 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee, and Representative Baje moves the A2. All those in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 is adopted to get the bill in the shape you'd prefer it. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Sorry to be up here two times in a row. but the amendment basically adds a section of law in 504B where the provisions of this bill would also apply. The amendment also adds a timeline for the notice for the tenant must provide to the landlord before starting the repair process. And I'll just go through the things that are in the amendment, and then I'll talk about the bill. The amendment also lays out how the tenant must notify their landlord about the repair needed through methods of communication that they usually use. The amendment also clarifies that if the repair corresponds to an appliance, the appliance stays with the landlord when the landlord reimburses the tenant for the appliance. It also notes that an additional remedy, if the remedy of deduction of rent is not possible, say if like the repair takes place in the last term of the month, then the landlord should also should pay for the associated cost directly to the tenant. And so, what the bill does then overall is it provides a clear ability for tenants to address repairs when a landlord is unresponsive to the needs of the property. Tenants would need to document the repair and provide their landlord a 14-day notice about the repair. Should the landlord not respond adequately in that time period by either fixing the repair or laying out a timeline for a repair beyond the 14 days, the tenant, if they can do the repair themselves, can do that. And then they can receive a corresponding deduction of what the costs of the repair were from the rent. The tenant can either contract out for the repairs or do them on their own. If the repair is needed to be bid out, the tenant will need to provide bid information to the landlord at least 24 hours before repairs commence. Once the repairs are complete, the tenant would then provide receipts to the landlord for the proper deduction of rent or reimbursement if a deduction of rent is not possible. So we're bringing forward this bill because it's necessary to ensure that if a landlord is unresponsive or absent, a tenant does not need to wallow in that unit that needs a repair. And so this is helpful to tenants, especially those living in units that the repairs can be done on their own. For example, lawn care, porch or deck repairs, window repairs, or change of a non-working appliance. I just want to recognize that this is not an opportunity for tenants to, like, try to upgrade a unit, to try to get fancier appliances or something, but rather just to make repairs consistent with the amenities of in the unit. And any updates to the unit remain with the landlord once the tenant moves out. And so the goal of this bill is just having a system outlined in statute that will further clarify the rights of tenants in their living spaces. And then with that, if there are testifiers, I'll turn to them. Otherwise, take questions.
We do have one testifier signed up, Jennifer Spadine with Guardian Property Management. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Jennifer Spadini. I am the owner-operator of Guardian Property Management. Today, I'm here to respectfully express Minnesota Multi-Housing Association's opposition to House File 1094. The bill looks to provide an alternate method for repair issues on a property. We believe this bill to be redundant and an unnecessary addition to state statute, as remedies for these already exist that are well known and accessible. These remedies include calling the local housing inspector or city, filing a rent escrow case, a tenant remedies action called a TRA, or an emergency tenant remedies action, ETRA, which was expanded last session and has been effective only since January 1st. Under the TRA or ETRA actions, the court can order the housing provider to make the repair, appoint an administrator, rent abatement, court order repair and deduct, and any other relief deemed just and proper. For background, my firm Guardian is a registered agent to be an administrator of actions of TRA or ETRAs in Minnesota. Our firm is responsible to the court that the repairs are done in an expedited manner, following proper remedies and proper notice to the residents under 504B. We are accountable to the courts that everything is repaired according to state maintenance code. Permits are pulled and permits are closed. We are accountable to provide financial reporting to the court as well. This proposal, as drafted, does not provide that the repair professional needs to be licensed, bonded, or insured. The proposal does not provide a remedy if the resident is non-compliant with the requirements of the statute, such as if they do not use a professional to perform the repair, they provide improper notice, or they create a new liability due to an improper repair. Additionally, it appears to allow a resident or their guest who creates that need for repair to use this provision. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to share our concern with this proposal.
Thank you. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the testifier may want to stay there. So I guess the question would first go to the author. Let's say this happens and someone arranges for a repair to be made. In the case that there might be a faulty repair made by somebody who apparently doesn't have to be licensed, who's accountable for damages? Who's accountable for finally subrogating the housing provider and making sure that everything gets set back to normal?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. That's a great question. I think right now it would probably fall under the lease provisions around what damages are, particularly if those damages are proven to be willful. If they're not proven to be willful, then whatever accidental damages, whatever is in the lease, would be there.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can take this offline, but the definition of willful might be something that a good lawyer could drive a truck through. You know, it would seem that if you hire somebody who's not qualified to make a repair and they screw it up, that's my question, is who's going to pay for that to be brought back so that the property owner doesn't have to then have the repair done again, or that the property owner then isn't held accountable by the individual that screwed it up by hiring somebody not qualified and then takes them to court for the damage to their where they live. So lots of shaky ground there, Representative. Maybe you can help me understand your intent, or maybe I'm missing something in the language.
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. So, the purpose is really to make sure that if you have a landlord that's unresponsive, and that's why we put in the 14-day notice process. But to the point of, like, if you end up hiring someone that doesn't do a good job, I mean, again, you probably have to go back to the lease, because that's what the courts would look at to figure out who would be responsible. And so I think depending on what the damages provisions are in the lease is what the courts would look at as to who is responsible and who would have to pay.
And Mr. Chair, if I could direct that same question to the testifier.
Ms. Bedini.
So if the repairs are the responsibility of the property owner, so if they're done improperly, my guess is it would fall back on the property owner.
And thanks, Mr.
Representative Nash.
That's my concern, is that if the provisions removed in the amendment that hold or that require that somebody be licensed and bonded and so on, and let's say, you know, you hire your sister-in-law, her little brother, who once upon a time put a light switch in, and they come and they completely screw it up, the renter's not going to pay for that, although they should. So, I mean, that's my fear here, is that I understand that perhaps in an extreme case, I've never, when my wife and I rented many years ago, we had a responsive housing provider that came and took care of things. But this seems to allow for the worst case scenario of somebody to come in and potentially screw up more than just one apartment. But if you're dealing with plumbing or electrical, you could have adverse impacts for everybody else in the entire complex. So that's my concern.
Other member discussion? If not, I'll go to Lee John, Representative Dotson. You said it, yeah. Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Representative Bajay. I noticed in the language here, we don't have any limit on repairs as far as a cap on the limit. It looks like it could be a runaway train with that. Is there to put a cap on expenses? Have we looked into that at all?
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dossett. Yes, we have had that conversation At this point, we've decided not to go with the cap because we wanted to just be specific to each individual repair. There is a provision in the Senate bill that limits it to basically a comparable item. So if we take that amendment, that would be a type of limit that you couldn't run away with expenses because you would need to repair it with a comparable item.
Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I look forward to looking at that language. Thank you.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgey, I got a couple different things. One, first of all, I don't know if it was just an inadvertent miss with the amendment or not, but does the tenant have to make a 7-day or a 14-day notice before any action? The bill says both. One is on, the 7 is on line 2.7.
Representative Badgey.
Chair Howard, Representative Johnson, could you point me to that line again? I'm sorry.
Lee Johnson.
2 points up.
2 points up.
Towards the very end of the sentence.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, we can go back and match them up. The 14-day notice period for the tenant is really that's the procedure that the tenant has to follow. So they give notice, they wait 14 days. And then the landlord should come back to them either with a plan of action or with a repair before moving forward with these processes laid out in the bill. But we can look to make sure that the 7 days in line 2.7 and the 14 days in the amendment correspond with each other. So we'll double check on that. So thank you.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgey, I thank you. I think it needs to be the same for everybody. Another question I have is, in the original bill, before the amendment was put on, it required the tenant to get two quotes. Now it does not. Is there a reason for that?
Representative Badgey.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Yes, we did also discuss that, too. It was noted that sometimes tenants can have a hard time finding multiple bids from multiple contractors, so we wanted to reduce that barrier.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgey. I suppose most people don't have phone books anymore, but they have the Internet to look them up, so it's not that hard to do to make a phone call to have somebody get a quote. I do have some other issues with this bill. Representative Nash brought up the liability issue if somebody's doing the repair. There's times, I don't know if you've ever tried to get an electrician or a plumber at your house. Good luck. We are so short of them that they are hard to get a hold of. I can probably take more than 14 days to get an electrician to a house to do something. A plumber can be just as rough. So the vast majority of housing providers, they're going to want to get their stuff fixed as quickly as possible. This is going to be, could cause some issues down the road, because if there's no violations but somebody wants something fixed to their standard, is that going to qualify? We don't know the way this bill is. So it's an issue that I have concerns on, and I think it's going to actually be detrimental to housing providers to the point where we might lose them. I'm not sure if that's the game plan or not, but I'm concerned because we are desperately short of housing in Minnesota. On the last bill, we saw that Minneapolis isn't even keeping close to pace with their population growth. And doing more regulations and things with the housing providers is only going to aspirate that problem and make it much, much worse. So with that, I'm going to request a roll call.
There will be a roll call. Representative Badgey, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, again for your time. This is a bill that, you know, we've heard from tenants that sometimes understanding the clarity of the process is helpful, and that what we're doing is just outlining that in one spot in statute. So thank you, and I hope to earn the committee support to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Ms. Erdahl, please take the roll.
Chair Howard.
Chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Aye.
Lee Johnson.
No.
Representative Cha.
Aye.
Representative Dotsas.
Dotseth, no.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative Myers.
Nay.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Norris.
Aye.
Representative Perez Vega.
Yes.
Representative Petersburg.
No.
With an 8-5 vote, the bill as amended is approved and it's off to judiciary. Thank you, Representative Bajay. Now we get to switch chairs here.
Chair Howard, so it looks like the last bill on our agenda is House File 4556 from Chair Howard. Chair Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please. I will move the bill.
Chair Howard moves that House File 4556 be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair Howard, to your bill.
As we get set up, I want to do a little table setting, and then I'm going to first turn over to my testifier. Last year, the legislature approved legislation creating a work group on expediting rental assistance. And the background for this is we heard from Minnesotans who experienced real differences in terms of how long it takes someone who's experiencing an emergency to attain rental assistance. And often that rental assistance wasn't getting delivered in the time to help a tenant sort of intervene before facing an eviction or facing homelessness even. And so what we sought to do is bring a group of stakeholders together from across different state agencies, counties, subject matter expertise, bringing in lived experience of folks to really dig into this issue to see how we can deliver what tools the state and others could have to meet this moment and deliver rental assistance in a more timely basis. And I think I'm going to hold my comments for now and turn it over to my testifier to talk a little bit about what that work group looked like to get us to the point of this bill and these recommendations here today.
Thank you, Chair Howard. The first testifier on the list is Katie Hott. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Agbaje, Lee Johnson, and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to provide an overview of the process for the Work Group on Expediting Rental Assistance, or WERA. My name is Katie Hatt, and I'm a senior management consultant at Management Analysis and Development, or MAD. MAD is the state of Minnesota's management consulting practice. We offer a wide range of services to public sector clients, including state agencies and local governments. MAD has conducted legislative studies for many state agencies, and the legislature sometimes also reaches out and asks us to conduct studies, or in the case of WERA, to facilitate task forces and work groups. The Work Group on Expediting Rental Assistance was established, as Chair Howard just noted, during the 2023 legislative session. The legislature created the work group to study how to expedite both the processing of applications for rental assistance and emergency rental assistance, and also the distribution of rental assistance funds to rental property owners. The legislature directed the workgroup to identify what processes, procedures, and technological or personal resources would be necessary to enable state or county agencies administering rental assistance to meet two goals related to timeliness, as seen on this slide. So the first being, within 2 weeks of receiving a completed application for rental assistance, make and issue a determination on the application. And the second being that within 30 days, starting from that same first day, so 30 days later, receiving a completed application for rental assistance to issue payment on approved rental applications to property owners. There are three programs identified as in scope for the work group through the enabling legislation, and those are in the blue box on the right side of the slide, the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program, which is administered by Minnesota Housing, and Emergency Assistance and Emergency General Assistance, which are both at the Department of Human Services. The work group consisted of 16 people, including Minnesota Housing and DHS leadership, representatives from organizations who work with people seeking various kinds of assistance relating to housing, including Homeline, United Way, Salvation Army, Community Action Partnership, Community Mediation Minnesota, the Family Housing Fund, Min Minnesota Legal Aid, and the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Additionally, four county administrators of emergency rental assistance, including two from metropolitan counties and two from greater Minnesota, and one member each from the House and the Senate. A full roster of members is included in the final report, which I believe you have a copy of in Appendix B. The legislation named Matt as the facilitator of the work group and specified that the work group must meet at regular intervals as often as necessary to accomplish its work. The full work group met monthly over Zoom for 3 hours each month with a public live stream available on YouTube. Subgroups focused on specific programs in scope met monthly in the early information gathering stage of the work group, and an operations subgroup helped guide process and logistical issues, such as developing agendas and providing input on meeting design and process. This slide outlines the roles of workgroup members and partners which supported its work. Workgroup members brought expertise and gained new knowledge over the course of learning both at and outside of meetings. They led individual consultations with experts and organizations who administer emergency rental assistance and work with people who have lived experience seeking housing assistance. With this knowledge and insights, workgroup members brainstormed options, prioritized these options, and developed draft recommendations. They heard feedback and suggestions from agency subject matter experts and considered revisions. They approved final language for recommendations and draft legislative language, fulfilling two requirements of the legislative directive. MAD served as the WERA process facilitator. This included designing meetings, preparing agendas, scheduling, running technology, and preparing documentation, including meeting summaries and the final report. The workgroup relied on subject matter experts from both Minnesota Housing and the Department of Human Services, who managed the three programs in scope. These staff attended meetings to ground the workgroup in program information, respond to questions, and offer suggestions. They were also accessible to the workgroup and to MAD throughout the process to answer questions and provide expertise. The nonpartisan House Research Department and Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis Department provided invaluable assistance to translate the workgroup's recommendations into draft legislation here before you today. The next two organizations on the slide, Family Housing Fund and Research in Action, shared related research and community engagement learnings with the workgroup. Family Housing Fund, which was also a member of the workgroup, and Research in Action each presented twice at workgroup meetings and provided written information to workgroup members with a focus on bringing the expertise and perspectives of people with lived experience to the workgroup process. A bit more detail about external consultation and outreach as part of the workgroup process. The legislation which created the workgroup, as noted on this slide, required consultation with individuals and organizations who are working on these issues, as well as with Minnesota's tribal nations. The work group, as individual members and a collective group, approached this in several ways. Members sought input from individuals and organizations and shared notes back to the full work group from each meeting or conversation. These consultations took place outside of meetings and included conversations with nonprofit organizations, community groups, tribal governments, local governments, and state agencies. Tribal engagement began with outreach to the tribal liaisons at both the Department of Human Services, Office of Indian Policy, and at Minnesota Housing. Following guidance from the liaisons, workgroup members reached out to the Minnesota Tribal Collaborative to prevent and end homelessness and to specific tribal staff as suggested by agency liaisons. Two workgroup members met with the chairperson and a staff member of the Minnesota Tribal Collaborative in November to learn about the collaborative's experiences with the programs in scope, discuss draft recommendations, and discuss whether they would achieve the goal of expediting processing of applications and payments. The collaborative representatives reported they felt the recommendations would do so. As noted on the previous slide, two organizations shared significant information and insights with the workgroup, both in presentations at workgroup meetings and written materials. Both organizations were conducting independent work concurrently with workgroup process and have also recently completed final reports. Links to those reports are included in the WERA final report. Here is a snapshot of the workgroup process for the months between September 2023 and February 2024, as listed in the left column. The next columns indicate topics or focus areas for both full workgroup meetings as well as those subgroup meetings on the specific programs in scope. The iterative discussions and learning through the first meetings provide a grounding in relevant knowledge among workgroup members, who then transition to brainstorming options for consideration and prioritizing those ideas based on relevance to the timeliness considerations. Workgroup members signed up to prepare first drafts of recommendations, working in pairs. These recommendations were refined with input from workgroup members and subject matter experts. At the workgroup's January meeting, the workgroup finalized recommendations language, and the House and Senate staff began drafting legislative language, which was reviewed and approved by the workgroup in February. Throughout the process, the workgroup sought to make decisions through a consensus-based model. In final votes on both the draft recommendations and draft legislative language, there were no dissenting votes. As I wrap up today, here is an overview of the contents of the final report for the Workgroup on Expediting Rental Assistance, which was submitted to the leaders of this committee and its Senate counterpart last Thursday. With that, I thank you again for the opportunity to testify today about the workgroup process. I'm happy to answer any process questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll continue to move on to the other testifiers. Ellen Sahli is next on my list. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Hi, I'm Ellen Sahli. I'm president of the Family Housing Fund. Thanks for the opportunity to appear in front of you today. The Family Housing Fund is a nonprofit organization with a 44-year history of helping communities address their housing needs. We work in the metro area. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 4556. At the Family Housing Fund, we work collaboratively to address barriers to help Minnesotans achieve housing stability. And we have years of experience working with the emergency financial assistance system. Prior to the pandemic, we worked with the county court systems to align resources to help families facing eviction. During the pandemic, we distributed more than $38 million of federal emergency rental assistance in the metro area. And then drawing on these experiences, last year the Family Housing Fund engaged stakeholders to join a process to reimagine the programs of EA, EGA, and FHPAP. And we refer to these three programs as our safety net. At the end of our robust community engagement, we issued two reports that speak to the experiences of emergency financial assistance administrators, renters, and property owners, and we also outlined recommendations for a reimagined system. And because of our work, I have a deep understanding of the complicated programs that families in crisis are forced to navigate, and a deep appreciation for the program administrators who balance the needs of many with limited resources. And I know that at the current funding levels and the intense demand for services, our emergency financial assistance system functions not as a safety net, but a lottery. The full report of the work group provides a roadmap for how we can build a system that ensures Minnesotans in financial crisis have a transparent and easy to navigate path for help, that it responds in the speed of the crisis, and that it is funded at the level that ensures it catches all who needs it. This requires funding to support administrative staff at the level needed to process timely applications. It requires investment in technology to help simplify the process for everyone, and it requires collaboration across systems, state agencies, and stakeholders. And this bill is the foundation for that reimagined system. The Family Housing Fund community engagement, we also came up with some recommendations that in many ways mirror the recommendations of the work group. And why is that important? For both of our recommendations, we have deep engagement from community stakeholders. And I might even say that that's really a mandate for change for our system. So I'm in strong support of the vision that was outlined in the work group, and I urge your vote in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And the last testifier I have on my list is Renee Rock. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Renee Rock. Sorry, my first time doing this. I know there's a proper way to address you, Chair Howard and committee, correct?
Yes.
Thank you for allowing me to be here today to speak directly to you on HF4556. I am a member of the SHIP Collaborative. The SHIP Collaborative is a group of concerned citizens and advocates for the well-being of individuals facing housing instability in Minnesota. The current state of evictions in our state is alarming, with records reported statewide, including Greater Minnesota. The predominant cause for eviction filings is non-payment of rent, highlighting a critical need for an expedited, trauma-informed, and culturally responsive emergency financial assistance program. We commend the proposed legislation developed by the work group, the WERA work group, aimed at addressing issues within the emergency financial assistance programs, and would like to emphasize the importance of making access to EA, EGA, and FHPAP faster and in a more timely fashion. We also believe a universal application process for emergency financial assistance programs will go a long way to enhancing all programs. We suggest enhancing this bill by incorporating a more comprehensive trauma-informed approach to emergency financial assistance programs. This will not only expedite the application process, but also provide a more empathetic and supportive experience when applying for emergency financial assistance programs. Please take into consideration the additions to this bill. I'm trying to scroll down. So I apologize. This is not. I apologize. My phone had died earlier, and a letter was on there, so I'm ad-libbing here. My apologies. I do want to thank you for your time on behalf of the SHIP Collaborative, and we look forward to working with you and the committee in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
If there are other members in the public that would wish to testify, seeing none, I'll move to member discussion.
Representative?
Oh, Chair, sorry. Chair going back to
Chair Howard, I'm sorry.
No, I know. That's usually what we do, but I just think it might be appropriate to offer a little bit more comment on the
please.
Bill.
Yep. We'll go to Chair Howard first, and please add more context to the bill.
Yep. First, I want to thank MMB and the MAD team that testified. I served on the task force. Myself and Chair Port in the Senate were the two legislative members, and I mean, this is really complicated stuff, and we gave a lot in sort of what we needed to dig into, and I was just so impressed by the MAD team and their ability to get a big group of us to study this issue and work together. And I also want to thank every member on the committee or on the task force, because it really was a group that leaned in, provided their expertise, including our agency partners at Minnesota Housing and DHS. And it was nice that at the end of the process, we had unanimous support on everyone on the task force for the recommendations that we brought forward. And I think what I wanted to do is highlight what our group identified as the key barriers for Minnesotans to access rental assistance in a timely basis. We noted that insufficient funding creates this scarcity mindset, creates rules amongst individual counties, et cetera, to sort of preserve those resources, but sometimes that can have a deleterious impact in terms of or setting up more barriers to actually access the resources. We also identified, you know, that there are multiple programs run by multiple agencies, county, state, otherwise, and it's this web that can be really difficult for anyone to navigate, let alone someone who's experiencing a housing crisis. We also noted the pressures on administrators to sort of deal with the incoming, so to speak, and that can vary county to county, et cetera, but some of that crunch was exhibited across the state, not just in the metro area. And we also identified technology barriers, language barriers, documentation requirements, all things that can sort of trip up an application process that can prevent the speediness of rental assistance. And again, why that's so important is that can be the difference between someone facing eviction or facing homelessness if they're able to process an assistance claim. And so after identifying the barriers, the task force set out with recommendations that were in a few buckets that became really the tenets of this legislation. One, reducing barriers and improving access for the Minnesotans that are applying directly for the emergency rental assistance. Two, looking for ways we can improve access through simplifying language and the verification process. Also, proactively engaging with rental property owners. I'll note that we had great engagement from our landlords, our housing providers that were part of the work group. Third, pursuing technology improvements that enhance the experience for applicants and integrate amongst different programs. Fourth, I think this one's really important, development of an annual assessment of need so that we kind of have a better sense to align funding with the actual needs of Minnesotans who are experiencing a housing crisis. And last, to enhance data collection and develop criteria so that we measure, if we implement some of these things, are we getting it right? Is it making a difference? Are we improving the experience? So those really were the key factors that undergird this legislation. And maybe it's worth stopping there. And I can speak to how the legislation addresses in those buckets, but I guess the last thing I'd say is the breadth of the legislation includes both things that I think we should take a look at doing now, also things that are maybe structural, more long-term pieces that will require more time, more investment, et cetera. I think we can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time, but this legislation offers a comprehensive approach that I believe in its entirety would make a huge difference for Minnesotans and improve our systems to meet the needs of our communities all across the state.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I guess we can now move to member discussion. I see Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Chair Howard. What is the fiscal implication of this moving forward? Because I don't see a fiscal note and I don't see a direct appropriation. So something has to come up somewhere to pay for this. So if you could help with that.
Chair Bajay, Representative Nash, good question. A fiscal note has been requested, and so that's in the works. You're absolutely right. There's going to be financial implications of this, and to move it forward, we need to have a full understanding of those financial needs. I think there's pieces of here that we can do on a policy basis or without kind of a significant price tag. Some things like redesigning entire IT systems obviously would encounter a big price tag, and so that needs to be part of the conversation before this moves forward.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chair, are you intending to lay this over?
Chair Howard.
We are intending to move this out to continue the conversation, but we'd have to bring it back if we're going to consider a funding bill that includes these pieces here in housing.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And remind me, where is the motion to send us to next?
Chair Howard.
The motion is to send this to health. There's impacts with DHS, and so we want to send it to health.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it your promise that this will come back before it gets a vote on the floor? Because, once again, we've had all last year bills moving out of fiscal committees without the fiscal note traveling along with it, and I was hoping that we were done with that.
Chair Howard?
Yes, you have my commitment that if we're going to move things that attached funding, we'll have another opportunity to have a discussion here in Minnesota Housing, or in the Housing Nash. Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next on the list is Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Vice Chair Egbaje, and to Chair Howard for bringing this forward. This is quite meaty and complex, and I think I know a lot of us are still digesting, I know myself. But I just wanted to thank our testifier, Roxanne, was it? Renee rocks. You rocked it. But I think what you brought into the conversation and looking at page 42, the people first and human centered, and obviously there's funding mechanisms and broader goals and feasibility and all these things that we need to work through, and we will do that and have more conversation and come together and tackle it. But I think that the people first and human centered, reducing barriers for applicants completing applications. I actually just received a letter from a group in Greater Minnesota called Streetwise, and they're all folks who have experienced being unstably housed or who are navigating this process now and talking to community members who are actually managing these programs, who are telling us that it's the way that we approach it, right? It's that the forms can be 50 plus pages long, and I just wanted to read to you to ground us in what we're doing here, their words. They said, as we know, when we are treated good, welcomed, and someone sees we can do more with our life and believes in us and assists us with the process of lengthy forms, it makes a massive difference in how we feel about our life and about ourselves. So it's our turn to have a simple and to-the-point form that works for us and treats us with dignity and humanity. And so just a comment there that as we move forward, I think that trauma-responsive, culturally affirmed from the jump is so crucial part to this. So thank you for that.
Representative Howard, any?
Yes, I want to thank Representative Kozlowski, and I want to thank the testifier as well. I think that there is, one, this came up through the work group, and I think that there's room to strengthen the language based on, because it's so critical. And we have staff folks all across the state that do amazing work to connect folks to assistance, but those folks are burdened by quite a bit of things, and it's really important that, again, that we sort of see this through the lens of somebody who's facing a housing crisis and what that feels like, and things like training for folks that are assisting folks. I think there's other ways to sort of make sure that we're paying attention, because this isn't just purely about let's try to get that assistance in a shorter amount of time. How we do it matters too, and so I just think that's really important. I think that our testifier, and look forward to working together on the language.
Next on the list is Lee Johnson.
Chair Abadji, Chair Howard. I understand the concept of this, and Representative Nash brought up the issue I had was the fiscal note, because there is going to be costs to this, both in health and human services. But I like the idea we actually get a fiscal note for the first time from the housing. Generally, they don't provide them. They're never asked for them. And talking with Commissioner Ho, she would mention that she wouldn't mind getting some of them so they have a better idea what's going to be happening in the future so they can plan. So it's something to think about, start requesting fiscal notes on housing bills. I understand there's some, not everywhere, that there's an issue with delays in getting this stuff done. In fact, I just had today an organization up in, that covers my area, Lakes and Pines. They do a fantastic job. They have the emergency funds to get them through this month, and they work with them to do the process and get the paperwork to get that assistance if they need it and they qualify. But what I like even better about their program is they are now doing training and some classes in financial responsibility and what needs to be done. Because I'm getting tired of the issue where we're giving them funds, but we don't help them get out of their situation. And we need to start doing more training and maybe look at requiring some training of those people that are on these programs to get them out of the situation so they're not consistently just on the programs. So I hope you'll include something like that with this bill as it moves forward.
Chair Howard?
Thank you for the comments, Representative Johnson. I do think it's good to get from Minnesota Housing the sort of costs and what it's going to take to implement some of these things. To your point, I think part of this piece is making sure that our systems and government are a little more responsive to folks when they're facing that housing crisis. And what I would say that we learned through this task force over many, many hours is that we have work to do in state government, in county government, to create systems that are more easy to navigate. And that's what this bill really seeks to do, under the notion that really all of us should have an opportunity for a safe and stable housing situation. And that's just not the case right now. And so this is a bill in the right direction. And it's one that really takes a holistic, long-term approach to it. I'm really hopeful that we can move the needle on some of this session, but it's also a framework for really long-term structural work that we all need to keep our eye on the ball on. So thank you.
With that, any final comments, Chair Howard?
That was kind of my final spiel.
All right, sounds good. Seeing no further comments, Chair Howard renews the motion that House File 4556 be re-referred to the Health and Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is on its way, and House File 4556 is referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair Howard, do you have any other further announcements?
Let's end this thing, huh?
All right. That being the final agenda item today, we are adjourned.